Welcome to Trafica Europe Radio, Europe's radio station, free online. Before today's episode, I want to take a moment and give a couple of announcements about the project. Firstly, our latest issue, Essential New Literature of Lesser-Known Languages of Europe, is now live on our website. Go to www.traficaeurope.org to check it out. Last week's episode with Jade Will and Ligia Parinasha included excerpts from the collection Borderlands, which can be found in the issue. This week's episode is no exception. You'll soon be hearing from Faroese poet Kim Simonsen. Excerpts from two of his poetry collections appear in the issue. In this episode, we'll include readings of the original Faroese, as well as the English translation read by translator Randy Ward. Before we jump into this episode, I just wanted to remind everyone to go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/traficaeurope, to check out our membership opportunities. There are a lot of ways to get access to extra content from Trafica Europe that'll make it really worthwhile. Plus, you'll help us keep doing what we do best, providing literature from Europe to all of you. With that being said, let's get into today's episode. Before we hear from Kim Simonsen, let's hear a poem read first by him in Faroese and then by translator Randy Ward in English translation.
Enda morgunen, da ju popmun, en byrjande dagur helmast. Hun ekka tuymar i jöst, fjallatsromne klödd kava. I jaren skjedde en harar uppe, men helt av i renna, så skjedde han attur. Ta i fannan var helt en hötten skott i av. Nu hälsar bry med det någon som kommer snutjande myskre som vär släpper späckliga korkar där snock.
This morning, my father died. The faint trace of a dawning day. In a few hours, it will be light. The ridgetop is covered with snow. I shot a hare up there yesterday. She kept running, so I hit her again. When I found her, half her head was blown off. Heavy surf hails the day, stealing into view. Darkness slowly releases its stranglehold on us.
We'll be hearing more poems read throughout this episode as we go along, but I just want to take a moment to state that these poems come from two different collections. The biological composition of a drop of seawater is reminiscent of the blood in my veins, and a second collection, What Good Does It Do for a Person to Wake Up One Morning This Side of the New Millennium? I'd like to start off by asking Kim to tell us a little bit about these two collections. What themes are present in each of them, and are they forthcoming in English, already published in English? Just give us a little bit of insight into these two texts.
Yeah, the second one is actually forthcoming in English. It's going to be published by Deep Vellum Press in 24. And I'm also going to be giving a talk and some readings in New York, actually, in April. While the first collection is pretty new, it was published in June, and I was lucky to win an award for that actually a little bit before it actually was published, because I won the best poetry in the Faroe Islands, which was a rather big competition, and there was a lot of people who participated in that competition. But I just sent like the 10 first poem of my upcoming collection, and therefore it got a lot of attention when it arrived a couple of weeks later after I won that award. The biological composition of a drop of seawater is similar to the blood in my veins. It's a very long title, and the other one has a long title as well. But in between these two books, there's another book there. It was called December Morning, which I'm not going to speak about today. Anyway, I put forward a lot of questions in my writing, like questions like, what is the philosophy of fish, the natural history of the little fish called the tree-spined stickleback, what is the human race position in regard to nature? And here we are already arrived at something that is usually profoundly important to me in my writing, because it deals with a sort of a new materialistic approach, also a so-called post-humanistic approach, because we're always facing the idea of perceiving the human self being very central in art and in poetry or science or what have you. But in the last years, we have also seen a number of traditions who are actually reflecting on other kind of approaches. In this specific poetry collection, my last one that is, I'm also thematically dealing with the death of my father. It's not only the I in the poetry collection that is experienced this, but I also was experiencing that when I started to write the poetry collection. And he had been a sailor his entire life, and so the ocean was like his element. So the entire poetry collection is about the ocean, but also about the ocean within ourselves, about water and salt water. It comes in the title, and it is probably the last thing that is put forward in the last line of this collection, and everywhere in between has to do with this watery element. Beside that, I'm working with worms and fish and trees and jellyfish, and constantly not only referring to biological diversities, but I'm also, if you can say, phenomenologically inclined to try to put myself or put the I into a not only a pointing state of mind, but also a, in terms of writing, that is, that if you say, for example, there's a rose, it's not very clear what you mean. And rose is the oldest motif you have in poetry, pretty bland but boring. So you have to be really inventive if you are going to write about natural phenomena like grass or a rose or worms or a fish or tree. So I developed a lot of techniques. If you compare them to having a camera, you might say that I have a, not a super wide angle, but I have a zoom. I'm zooming in on very small things, small living things. And sometimes there are even viruses and bacteria or life processes and everywhere in between, from the death of my father to how life actually starts in nature. And the whole, you can say circle if you want, but to write a whole poetry collection about the death of somebody, and especially the death of one of your parents, it sounds so bleak, it sounds so sad. But as some of the reviewers already have picked up on and are stating, that this is not a sad poetry collection at all. This is a tribute to life. It's a tribute to everything that is, every critter, everything that is creeping and crawling. And it's like trying to develop this awe of everything that is out there. So going back to this approach to point is, I'm also a teacher in creative writing, so I'm constantly trying to take the students out in nature, trying to take them out there, because I know their writing is going to change. I know that. If you ever had a kid, or if you've been a kid, you have open kids. So when our parents took us out there, just out, and our moods changed immediately, just after 10 seconds, our moods change, and we can feel the wind, and there's another smell, and there's another ambiance, and everything together. And it's like our being inside doesn't really do justice to the whole comprehension of our five senses. So trying to write from a phenomenological standpoint to, for example, if you are supposed to say something about a rose, then, okay, let's do this seriously. Let's look at the rose from every angle, from above, from every side, and go very close, go far, look into its history. And that could be an approach for me in terms of styles and techniques in this. Mun kalda hond næstu við regnvata garden. He looked at a mold, he heard fugla vanger. He hugsi insektene, la makkar virus. Et ori myrskur hefur myrski á. Vi virus, vi hilgres, vi er hodja skottna. Vi er en som veit at om ikke anna skulle hese et av meg at enda som blælusen og dreper snilen som etter plantene.
My cold hand touches the rain-soaked fence. It smells of earth here. I hear the wings of birds. I think about insects, earthworms, viruses, that the word darkness has a dark sound. I am virus. I am weed. I am that which is moldy. I am one who knows that, if nothing else, all these will one day consume me, just as the aphid and the killer slug devour the plant.
So far, we've mainly focused on one of the collections. How does this compare to the other collection and other things that you've written in the larger scheme of things?
Both this collection and the other one, they might be a little bit different. The other one, the older one, is, I think it started a new kind of a style for me. And as I think I wrote it to you while we started to write to each other on email, that I'm trying to mold my own poetics to each and every book. And the older book, for me, constituted a sort of a turn towards something that I also have published books prior to that, like a couple of poetry collections and an essay collection and some text, some non-fictional works as well. I've been educated as an academician, PhD and so on. But anyhow, I guess the big turn for me also happened in a lot in Scandinavian poetry, that you can describe it as the sort of an interest in the material. It was also a turn away from a more postmodern, post-structural discourse-based poetry, language-based poetry, and towards a poetry that has been called a lot of different names, and I don't like many of them. They're called eco-poetry or something like that. I'm not a fan of these names, and I don't fit very well in there, actually, because some of the eco people, they can also have a lot of political aspirations, and you feel like you constantly have to agree with them. You might feel that, especially the older one, like Gary Schneider and the American tradition in the 70s and in the 80s. But we already had these people going around in Denmark, for example. We have Inger Christensen, the world famous poet, and she had a completely new take on nature, for example. And she was never preaching anything like, oh, we should take care of our nature, we should understand that we are part of it. It was nothing like that. It was there. And it didn't have the romantics. They were romanticizing nature. And that is just as hating nature, because we are trying to avoid a anthropocentric version of fiction. If we are personalizing, and we do that constantly with whales and dolphins, and we have these ideas about higher animals, and the more human-like they might be, the more interesting they seem to be for us. And that is also a very romantic Disney kind of dealing with nature. But back to Inger Christensen, and in America, I might mention names as Mae Bessenbrugge. She's an awesome writer also, and as a phenomenological writer as well. I don't feel any real big familiarity with these eco-whatever, especially not those names, because you wouldn't say that, like in the 70s, they talked about female writers or feminine writers. You wouldn't say that anymore. Maybe the feminine issues and topics have been blended into mainstream, so you wouldn't think about it. The same is going to happen with writing or art that deals with nature in a certain or specific way that maybe it mentions. For example, I was reading a novel, a really good one, and it was about this woman who was interested in birds trekking from the South Pole to Greenland. I didn't realize until far into this book that it was actually about a future scenario where there practically weren't so many birds around anymore. But that is going to be, or is already maybe, the future or the presence of these nature narratives, that the more we get attuned to it, the more it becomes the backdrop of just about everything. So the whole eco, whatever, it's going to dissolve itself, because if the world has changed, the fiction and the poetry will probably change as well. So there's no need for having a certain category of ecological or eco-poetry. At least what I think will eventually happen with this tradition. But I'm pretty far away from those, even though I'm deeply immersed in nature. I always have another narrative. I have other narratives that, for example, the death and life of my father. And in the other one, there is a narrative about a sort of ending relationship, which you can feel that going throughout the whole. It was back in 2012 and 13 I wrote it, and the new millennia was a thing we had to get used to back then. Now we are 10 years down the line, so we don't think about so much anymore, but wow, we're in the 21st century. What did I forget in the 20th century? Did I get everything? What happened there? That was the gateway for me to say a lot about the world. And I have a very sort of distinctly different time frame, because I'm working with times that were eons away, perm or trias or whatever, and I'm also working with future times that are 5,000 years away from us now, or trying to look into overlooked. And I was interviewed at some other place, and I remember that the headline of this interview became something with maybe planet Earth was the paradise we never saw. And that is a good line for me, because I think I'm not only fascinated by science, I'm also interested in this strong connection between art and sciences, but also the history of natural history. That goes back to my childhood, having a grandfather who gave me a lot of books about Darwin. And I grew up in a very Christian, not a Christian family, but the society I grew up in around me was fairly Christian. So I was hiding on the back row in my school, reading Darwin in a class called Christianity and asking all sorts of subversive questions at the age of 12 about this and that. And remember asking a question about why did Adam and Eve have navels on the pictures of them, since they were created by God. It was a long time ago. But this interest comes up with a lot of new theorists and a lot of people who are straddling those lines between poetry, art / poetry, and science, and who are dealing with doing theories about our related relations between man and nature, because we are very estranged to our own nature, unfortunately. Also, if we go back to the Greeks, to Aristotle, he's usually taken forward these days, because he had a sort of a very hierarchical pyramid. We can picture this as a pyramid where he sees that on top of everything, there's the gods, and after that, human comes treading along on top. But under everything comes higher animal, lower animal, plants. So this has also been transported into Christianity at one time or another. The high pitch of this, you find Descartes in the 16th century, where he defines matter, cognitive matter, that which is thinking and that which is not. Animals become what is not thinking, there's res extensa and res cogitas, and animals becomes res extensa, which means that they have no soul and they don't have any feelings. So kicking a dog, drop kicking a dog, would be like to hear a door screeching. It's a brutal essence of that, because of this human superiority that this entails. If you go back to the humanistic ideals, you see this image from Galilei, where you have this humanistic man, this old drawing of the circle, and the man is in between. We're seeing humanism exchanging God. So now the human is God. And that has always been an ideology, if you think about it. It is a very sacred ideology for many people still, even in the humanities at universities. But it has an effect on what has been considered interesting since the 15th, or even before that, and after that. While the Middle Ages, which are seen as so dark, of course, there was a religious supremacy, but they had rooms for another cosmology when it comes to, for example, the role of nature and man. Because if you look into many of these old fairy tales and what have you, there might be this dangerous journey that the prince or princess is going to go to, and he meets this troll or a goblin or very sort of seductive mermaid. But most of the time, the essence of these stories were actually that many of these creatures, they all most of the time live in nature. So they are actually the epiphany of some sort of a nature. And while the humans go in and distort that nature, there will be a revenge which is going to be bestowed upon them, and they will most of the time die or be killed, or most of the time they don't succeed. Seen from a modern philosophy of nature perspective, these old medieval cosmologies are more in tune with what nature is, given, for example, Corona, which, what didn't Corona do to us? Also, because COVID-19 is very much a part of why my book there from 2013, which is translated into English now, it's dealing a lot with viruses, and it became so interesting, or it became relevant, especially of the COVID-19. Direkt nåt han slid i dagvis, behöver en hävd och himmel renna samman. Vid er en flåtan till omskiftan till stöva. Nu spyrar gode soppar att åtkänt i öjtjetsövån med en sälde för nior och börskrin i fötterna av trövnån. Er jo ahua rut ikkje menneskas lea. Vi insekton, virusen, vi bruna, vi ötlån. Som leker och drippar med tlockare, porös och porer.
It's rained without cease for days. The fields, the sea, the sky blur together. We are liquiform state of flux. Yellow fungi sprout from decaying oaks as the sun goes down. The bark has fallen off the trees. I'm interested in the non-human, the insects, the viruses, infection, everything that leaks and drips between our porous pores.
Let's probe into these a little bit further. So you mentioned towards the beginning of your response that your approach is phenomenological, in the sense that there's a breaking down between what's human and what's nature. In one poem, you state simply that you're thinking about insects, worms, and viruses. And then after that, you follow it up with, I am virus, I am weed, and I am that which is moldy. Or at least that's how Randy Ward translated it. For you, how are humans and nature completely connected? Could you speak a little bit more specifically about that? I'm really curious. In this example, most times we don't think of virus, weed, and mold as positive things, right? So what is the importance of taking these things that often have negative connotations and placing them on the same level as the human?
Yeah, it's a good question. Your body is a wide concept, if you think about it, externally, internally. And one might also think about, why shouldn't poetry be about internal biochemical processes? Poetry can also be about everything. The first thing a surgeon does when he's delivering a baby, for example, from a cesarean section, is to put a finger in the mother's anus, because the newborn baby needs to jumpstart the culture of bacteria, otherwise the baby would die. This also brings me further on to thinking that the material that make up everything, also our cells, is also a part of a cosmological system. And someday we will also be dust and material again, which we already have been for a long time. I think that's a beauty that has my interest. So not seeing nature as sentimental or ornamental or a backdrop of real life or anything, but to see it as a real place. But also, there's been a surge and interest in the material, because if we look at a lot of the cosmologies, for example, a really important ism is modernism. How can you say anything bad about modernism? It's like, oh my God, you're an anti-modernism then. You're already perceived as a sort of a primitive. But I think that it's good to be able to evaluate everything. For example, modernism has the problem of having no philosophy of nature. It doesn't really relate to nature. And thus, you see modernism again and again in buildings, in architecture. These buildings are making humans feel alienated. Also, the philosophy of modernism was very concentrating on shock. But the philosophy of modernism also comes from different philosophies and different aesthetics. At the same time, it's very hard to say what that philosophy was. But in its base core, it was skepticist and it was idealist. The opposite of philosophical idealism. Idealism meaning that we cannot perceive what's out there. It's said by Kant already, the German philosopher, that we have the Ding an sich, the thing on its own, and the thing for us. So we are locked in this vortex. But today, 200-300 years after Kant, we have seen new evidence, new science. There was a physician who slowed down time, for example, meaning that time is maybe real. And there's numerous other proofs around. So if we concentrate on the opposite of idealism, realism, but realism is often perceived as being very sort of a naive. And realism in literature is one thing, but realism in philosophy is another thing. Realism in philosophy deals with that the objects are there sometimes and we have access to these objects. It doesn't matter if we perceive it or not. So the tree in the woods is going to fall whether or not we see it. The old story about that. Even today, I'm inspired by a direction that has been criticizing sort of a 90s, 80s post-structuralism and postmodernism. There was the Ian Bogas, he said that it was like escaping the halls of the mind's prison towards the grassy meadows of the material world. And why is he saying that? Because, as another one has also stated, that 20, 34 years ago, we had entered into sort of a post-structural fatigue, that we were so interested in these discourse and deconstruction. And I think the 90s was a very oblique time where many people didn't know what was coming and where they were and where they were going, also in terms of aesthetics, and in terms of philosophies, and in terms of literary theory, in terms of how poetry looked like. Therefore, I think that 2010, for me, around that area, given plus minus 5 years, we saw a turn towards realism and away from relativism, that it was that which also inspired me, that, for example, we can think about having an so-called object-oriented ontology. Objects are also interesting, and modern so-called animal studies, which is a field in environmental studies that deals with the relationship between other beings and humans, that we saw or have been seeing that the absurdities of continuing to hold on to these obsolete notions that animals have no real personalities and so on. So the speculative realism would go away from this ideal of man, this humanistic ideals from the 16th century, and try to escape away into a so-called anti-anthropomorphism, which we are always anthropomorphizing everything. You see it in comics, Donald Duck, and we also see it in documentaries about nature, that the narrative is always about the mother spider and the father spider and so on, but mother spiders don't care about their offspring. They get 3,000 of them and don't try to expand these roles that these having human parents and with two kids and try to force that into nature. That is extreme anthropomorphism going on. And also Donna Haraway has talked about the human exceptionalism that we are actually always ending up in, and she also talks about methodological individualism, that it's an ideal to not think about that. And also another philosopher is Bruno Latour, the French philosopher. If we, for example, would think about what matter has to say for us, also in poetry, it's not only in sciences and philosophy, but and these things bleed into each other, at least they do that for me. And I remember in 2010, that I lived in New York at that time, and it's very funny, there's actually a volcano back now in Iceland, there's a new volcano. But at that time, there was a volcano in 2010, and because of the small ashes that was in the air of Europe, we could not fly to Europe. But imagine if this ashes stayed in the air for 300 years, then our whole history would have changed, at least the history of aviation. So you can make a statement with Bruno Latour's theories that everything's tied together, everything's relational. There's always a network of circumstances, and there is a flat ontology because of these small dusts in the air. They could easily rewrite the whole history of the Western world, the modern man. So that's a materialistic ontology right there. We can also write the whole history of Europe about the rat, for example. It was the rats came to Venice. It was actually the fleas on the rats that brought about the plague. So the plague eradicated most of Europe. So these fleas, they changed the entire history of modern Europe. But we are constantly woven into a fabric that produces texts or historiographies or histories about man and royalty and emperors and princesses and so on and presidents, with no intention of having any interest whatsoever for everything that's around us, which is so human-centric and so chauvinistic and so utterly unintelligent. It's bordering on crime, a crime scene, that, for example, see a statue of some royal person on his horse. We would never stop for a moment to think about the horse. What was the role of horses back then in 1751? Did they have a good life, or were they a special breed? And often we can get everything wrong because we don't have any interest in that context. Ovid sier metamorfosen at ikke løvren i hverandre at hemsens enden og gjør i naturen at ikke hemmen skal gjøre kontor at alt skal brøytes.
In the Metamorphoses, Ovid says that nothing organic lasts forever, that nature is the world's great renewer, that nothing in the world perishes, that everything shall change.
All of these theories and ideas surely shed light on your poetry, as observed in the poems spaced throughout this interview. But could you talk a little bit more about these directly? How do they affect the works that we've been hearing?
Inevitably, these critical realists, Graham Harman, for example, a philosopher that I'm following with a great interest, that trying to close in on alternative frameworks of thought who are no more critical or positional, but affirmative. So we can have more caring and positive notions also. While in the 90s, poetry was in a very sort of a critical, oppositional, and deconstructional manner, while in new ways of writing and poetologies that we see people being more interested in caring and the affirmative. And once you go out in the world, we can see that there's a turn against the world, if you can say it like that. So the small fish in my poetry, the small everything, the viruses and bacteria and the dripping of whatever, it becomes not a threatening thing, but it becomes also something that is praised. So there's a praise, because if you take the human subject and put it into the, you marginalize it a little bit and let everything else also try to get a voice, which is of course impossible. Many of these dualisms that we have encountered, which are very unfortunate, for example, the dualism between culture and nature, which is obviously very stupid. You go into a park and then you see a bench and you're supposed to sit on the bench and look at nature. What's the problem there? You are nature. You're nature yourself. So you can take a mirror and look at yourself. So we have this idea, and as some have said, that nature is the problem. What does he mean by that? Nature is a problem because the notion of nature doesn't allow us to see that we are nature. So the notion, the idea of nature is ever shifting, and there's a cultural history to the idea of nature, which doesn't allow us to see nature. But then we have isolated the notion of nature into different modes. For example, we can talk about pastoral modes in writing. I'm not against the pastoral. Pastoral actually means shepherds originally. But we see that already early onset in the late 18th century, we see a anti-pastoral coming up, that we see poets that are actually criticizing the destruction of nature. So the modern pastoral in the middle of the 20th century is a death pastoral more. It's about the dying of nature. So the pastoral becomes relevant, and I'm also in my latest poetry collection, I'm inspired by this theoretical book called The Death Pastoral by Joelle McSweeney. She's an American poet, and she wrote this brilliant text some 10 years ago, I think. Also, I'm inspired by her own work as a poet. Where she's actually finding some long lines, visiting a lot of poetry from different areas of the world, Europe, Asia, America, and so on, where in Mexico, I think, and South America, where she sees the same sensibilities towards these necropastorals. So that is definitely also an inspiration of mine. Is it you felt that word for an archetto, if in your sart and bring grey cow on, make your palm, with a knap on us, hey, me and a blower, me tassing up the hunt ma, or run a very man, how white, or ye white, eh, to what that?
I see the paw prints of a cat and find a wounded robin in the snow. He looks up at me with his beady eyes as he bleeds. I pick him up and try to warm him in the palm of my hand. He knows. I know. It's over.
I think that ties interestingly in two ways. One that you've already mentioned, and one that popped up from another poem that came to me as you were talking. You mentioned previously the exploration of your father's death in the collection and how that didn't necessarily paint the entire collection as mourning, grief-filled, or depressive in any sense of the term. That makes me think of one of the poems that you read here, where we see the sea reacting potentially to your father's passing, but then continuing on and still washing over everything, going back to its usual patterns. So having that kind of connection being there, but then that idea of a return to what is natural and normal coming afterwards really stood out to me. The other thing that stood out to me is in one of your poems that you write, I'm interested in the non-human, the insects, the viruses, infection, everything that leaks and drips between our porous pores. First, I adore the translation of porous pores. I think it's just beautifully filled with such meaning. But just the idea that the non-human being so tied to things that make us completely human and using the our in that context to fully drive that connection. There's one other topic that I wanted to bring up that I noticed in your work. The theme of death seems to make more sense knowing that you're exploring your father's death in the collection. But there were two poems that jumped out to me that treated death in two different ways. There's one about a robin that was attacked by a cat. You find the robin, and you both just know that the robin's life is going to be over. Then there's this other one in which you kill a hare. You have to actually, I'm assuming, shoot it twice based off of the poem. And its head finally explodes, and when you go find the hare, you see this mutilated corpse. So I'm curious, why such different treatments to death? One being what would seem necessary, feeding yourself with food that you find in nature, and the other being a cat who seems playful, attacking a bird, and leaving it there to die rather than eating it and participating in the kind of cycle of life. I'm just curious why there's these two very different versions of death.
Yeah, I don't have so many sentiments about what people are supposed to do. Of course, I'm very much against the treatment of farm animals. Like in Denmark, there are 15 million pigs. Denmark is the country with the most pigs per capita in the entire world, and most of them are treated extremely bad. And I adore the robins because I was lucky to have them just outside my window when I was writing. And it's actually a sort of an invasive bird to the Faroe Islands, which has recently just come here. And because of the climate changes there, we see all sorts of new life coming here, both in a good way and in a more challenging way. But I don't think that we should distinguish between invasive and not, because nature is invasive. Nature is all invasive. It's always been invasive. But if we can, I can really understand your question there, because when it comes to the hares, I've been a member of a club in this village, because who go out 1 month a year to have permission to hunt hares in a certain mountain. And that is also because of the huge, not population, but the whole number of hares is every year exploding. According to the researchers and the scientists, they say that we're actually doing them and nature a favor by taking a few of them out every year. But then again, I stopped hunting a couple of years ago because I don't like to end the life of intelligent animals like the hare. But in this specific scene, you might have shot a hare, but you don't know it because it keeps on running, and you shoot it again, and then it stops, and then you see, oh my God, I did such a great damage on this little body. And you feel terrible afterwards. So my sentiment was also to put that gruesome image into it, that maybe the I in the poetry collection is not so much me. I'm a very bad hunter. I only managed to get a hare once, I think. But some of the other hunters are 100 times better than I am. And then I don't think they should shoot so many of them. But I know there's a logical reason to that. It's a really good idea to do that. But then again, I might be a little bit sentimental about it. Jättimina blommor, saften för henne sprutar in i munnen.
I eat a plum. The juice shoots into my mouth.
It's interesting that the example comes once again from the idea that humans are trying to maintain and dictate what nature should be. So it's very interesting that that's where the inspiration comes from. The last thing I wanted to ask you is, you've mentioned a couple of different times throughout that you've moved around a lot. To New York, Denmark, Amsterdam, the Faroe Islands. I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about the influence that travel has had on your writing, whether that be specifically about the poems you reference New York in the older collection, if I'm not mistaken. Feel free to reference those, but I'm really curious just in general how travel has impacted your creativity.
Yeah, it's a sort of a mystical, it's a really good question. I'm mystified by it myself because I spent so many years of my life, like maybe 70% already, not living in a country where I actually was born and bred. And so I sort of went through all those emotions of being an exile or a migrant or whatever in living in other countries. Like I lived 8 years in Amsterdam and 2 times in America and Norway. And I traveled and worked a lot in the neighboring countries. Most of the time I lived in Denmark, but I also been a lot to Scotland and Iceland and Norway and what have you. And then I also just... especially when I was in my 20s and late 20s, I was like really massively traveling back then. I was constantly trying on new cities. But lately, in terms of writing, I was in China, for example, in 2016 for a festival there. And some of the poems I wrote about nature comes from China. It's a nature in China. It's not a nature here, but... you wouldn't really feel it because I'm not so much interested in the geographical specificity. I'm also been working on a novel, which I hope is going to be published next year. And there's a full chapter on China, and it deals a lot with nature as well, and America as well. But I'm always trying to find similarities. A fern is a fern, a branch is a branch, even it's in the Faroe Islands or in San Francisco. And jellyfish are jellyfish and might be a different jellyfish. They have hummingbirds and we have other birds, but still they're birds. But the whole cultural thing with New York and those poems, I think I wrote them many years ago, because when you come from a sort of a little bit obscure country and a small country, you might experience a lot of these sentiments that whenever you come into a stage somewhere, a festival somewhere, you almost have to have a world map with you, and there's Faroe Islands, and which I find to be a job that I don't really enjoy that much, because I rather speak about philosophy and poetics and so on. But the whole issue of geography also comes within mind, because the World Republic of Letters, which is a very sort of posh word, was founded in the 19th century. And in the 19th century, we had a very sort of a national idea about but each country had to develop its own literature and art and flags and national anthems and the whole matrix of nationalism, which makes us wonder a lot about still. And it's very hard to escape that matrix because we're all embedded into that matrix. It's like the fabric of society. We're still asking questions like, or you can see media or academics refer to, for example, this Icelandic artist. And when you think about it, he's not really Icelandic. He's half Danish and he lives in Berlin. And Ólafur Eliasson, for example, he does his art in Berlin and exhibits all over the world. And there's extremely little about this art that is Icelandic, except from him being half Icelandic. Sometimes these things become borderline absurd, but in other instances, it's not. But because there are these voices that are so transnational that they sort of... But I'm not trying to escape where I actually come from. I'm always saying to the students that I'm teaching, the writing student, that you have to, in your poetics, it's very important that you embed the self that you are writing about within a specific room. And this room has to be a concrete room. It's on a vertical level and a horizontal level. You need to embed and place this. The readers won't be able to follow you until you do that. Because if you just write in abstracts and the whole idea about universalism or so on, it's an abstract. So the more concrete you can be, write about weeds and small flowers and birds, a specific flower maybe, in a specific landscape, in a specific place, in a specific square meter of nature in the North Atlantic or wherever you are, the more relatable it becomes. But you can also probably universalize the specificity. These are not... These can be rooms that you can enter in and out of. But in the 19th century, the World Republic of Letters was founded, and there are all these chauvinism that comes from, for example, big countries that are very entitled. Like the English language is super entitled because they don't have to. Americans read very few translated books, and but we from all of these small languages and countries in Scandinavia and north of Europe, we have to master at least three languages just to get by, or four, or five maybe, or we can take all the Scandinavian languages, we have to know them and still. But the whole idea about having literatures that are put into sort of almost like stamp collections. You have the Finnish stamp collection there and the Swedish. And those stamp collections, they don't touch upon each other. They are perfect in their own shape and in their own space. That is very false. I think prior to the whole nation-state concept, if we go back to the 17th or 18th century, people, for example, in Copenhagen were mixing up a lot. Like French people were living there, Dutch people were living there, German people were living there. But after sort of the beginning of the 19th century, everything became Danified. So everybody had to speak Danish, and people changed their names into Danish names. And if an artist had sort of foreign motifs, they were at least so not successful anymore. But in short, that if we look, for example, at an area or a small nation in the realm of things like the Faroe Islands, we can say that, oh, they're small and they're there between Scotland and Iceland somewhere. But if you think about them in history, if you think about them in like their sea territory is, for example, massive. The sea territory of Faroe Islands is way bigger than the entire realm of Denmark. And their fisheries is also massive because of that. And there's a great wealth in the Faroe Islands because of these things. But if you think about it, and the whole notion, the romantic notion of this isolated Robinson Crusoe kind of tale about islands, it's a sort of a mirage, so European Eurocentric mirage of the exotified island. But if you think about it in terms of going back to, for example, the first people who ever went there to live, that history is constantly being rewritten, that they have found older remnants of older people from way back. So we are not sure which these people were exactly, but anyhow, if we fast forward up to the year 900,000, for example, we have the so-called Vikings, the Northmen, who actually inhabit that place along with Iceland, and they came from Norway, most likely. Yeah, we know that for a fact. But anyway, these people, they were not very placed in a sort of specific place. They were always traveling from Norway, Iceland, Faroes, and there was like a North Atlantic rim going all the way to Scotland, Shetland, Orkney, even to Ireland, Isle of Man. And it was a very sort of a lively trading place. They could actually come from the Faroes to Bergen in 16 hours. So even 1,000 years ago, these people were extremely connected. The whole notion of isolation is some belated romantic misunderstanding. And also when we fast forward to a later period of history, into the 18th century, with the whole triangular trade, the slave trade, if you like, between Africa and America, with European traders, say, also the Faroe Islands became very pivotal and important into that trade, because rich merchants from Denmark set up trading stations there, and so all sorts of cultures mingled there already, and people learned foreign languages and so on. That's a very sort of alien concept if you think about these sort of more stereotypical voices of today. And the strange thing is also that the national movement of the Faroe Islands, which is very strong in the 19th century and especially in the 20th century and still is, they firmly like to retell some of these stories about the isolated, because they are constantly using these historiographies to further on use history to tell a narrative about Denmark being an evil. These are things that I'm constantly grappling with and thinking in terms of. But one thing that is important is our magazines like this that you are publishing, and the translations of Randy Ward, which I'm very grateful for. We have been working together now for many years. He's a brilliant translator. And other translators that also have translated my work into Macedonian and Danish, and I was sometimes I'm also translating. Now I've begun to translate some collections, but not into my native language, but into Danish, so from my native language into Danish, because it is so important for people that are from smaller languages to be translated immediately to become parts of a bigger loop. So we see that in, for example, Faroese musicians, some of them famous musicians, that their real outcome, their real game for them is not really to have concerts in the Faroe Islands at all. It's for decades it's been to tour America or to tour other places. But that is also creeping into the art scene and creeping into how writers are going about. But top priority is of all of this is also there's a huge interest by the organization called Farlet. It's the organization that promotes Faroese literature abroad, and they also fund translations and fund trial translations, and they can help arrange meetings and sending people to literary events abroad and so on. Tver fyrnar, on dreidja trøn on the Washington Square Park, misti viti av ense mittle miljoner, a gul and bluvel. At han har sammanbrott ni hoen til å renne om han 9th Street, kjøp en kvitt han på til hund, sammen i toften av meg selv og sammen, røkte jeg en blå av galoasses og kjøpte jeg en bakke av jordbæren. Sliten tok i ellen til Brooklyn, tjøk millioner og utkjent av bøyerpørsten. En sida gul og bløy inn i førsten til skånen som nøy skittner, hund av lørsten.
Twice, under the oak trees of Washington Square Park, I lost my wits from loneliness among millions of yellow leaves. After my breakdown, and the urge to run down to 9th Street and buy a white poodle, I gathered my frayed nerves together, smoked a blue Gauloise, and bought a carton of strawberries. Exhausted, I took the L line to Brooklyn, through millions of the city's unfamiliar corners. The yellow leaves are still stuck to the soles of my shoes, like fresh dog turds. I think the big thing to take away from that, and combining these ideas of boxes and Latour's idea of connectivity and network, I'm actually going to go back to something you said at the very beginning of this chat, when you mentioned that looking at poems as purely eco-lit would completely cut off a network about grief and processing your father's death, for example, or looking at them as just poems about death and grief, put them into a completely different box. It cuts off all of those natural aspects that you're also investigating at the same time. So I think that's a very big and important message to think about. The questions of identity and borders are beyond anyone's personal control, let alone the existential questions that arise in us as we try to process them. I think the idea of openness to this network or this connectivity is super, super important. Translations being a very big role in that, or potentially playing a big role in that, absolutely. Kim, I would love to end with just hearing what you're working on now. You hinted at a novel earlier in this chat. Are there any other projects that you're working on?
You always have different projects in the works, of course. The poetry collection we have been talking about today, one of them, for me, lies a little bit behind in my history, so I was like 10 years younger when I wrote it. And the other one is very recent to me, from 2023. But immediately, when you give it to the publishers, you start working on something completely different, or have already started working on something different. I remember a famous Danish writer, which I respect, a poet which I respect very highly, Sir Ulrik Thomsen, he's always said that it should never talk about, well, in detail, talk about what you're working on because you might kill it. But I can say so much that I'm working on, apart from the novel, I'm working on two different poetry projects. And one element that relates to one of these poetry collections is I'm looking into breathing and air, as the other one is about water and the oceans, and this one is more about air and not being able to breathe. So I hope I will be successful in the upcoming year to be able to finish that, especially that one, that collection.
Amazing. We look forward to seeing what the future has in store for you. Kim, thank you so much for this riveting talk. I really appreciate all of your thoughts and all the care that went into these responses. You've been listening to Faroese author Kim Simonsen discussing his poetry and creative process. Throughout this interview, you've heard poems being read first in Faroese by Kim Simonsen, and then in English translation read by translator Randy Ward. The poetry collection, What Good Does It Do for a Person to Wake Up One Morning This Side of the New Millennium, is forthcoming from Deep Vellum Press in 2024. I want to give a special shout out to translator Randy Ward for connecting me with this work and with Kim Simonsen. I also encourage you to check out her website, randyward.com. Randy is R-A-N-D-I, WARD.com to check out her amazing works and projects. She herself is also a poet as well as an amazing translator. If you've enjoyed this episode, I highly encourage you to consider becoming a member of Traffica Europe. For the next few weeks, I'll be spotlighting one of our membership tiers, just to give you an idea about what you can get by becoming a member. For the price of just one grande caramel macchiato at some very famous coffee chains, you can become an audiobook listener. There's actually a teaser for this tier published right now, just after this episode. I highly encourage you to check it out. What you get as an audiobook listener is the access to our usual content, free online. You'll also get access to audio excerpts that are being read and produced by Traffica Europe from all of the literature that we published since the beginning of our journey in 2015. If you don't have the time to sit down and read an excerpt, you can always put on the audiobook episodes in your car and listen to it while you're heading to work. We're beginning with the works that are currently published in our latest issue, and then we'll slowly work back through our archive to give you all of our other issues read out loud for you to enjoy, and accompanied with a little bit of biographical information about the author. Traffica Europe is a nonprofit organization that only continues thanks to donations and memberships. So, if you're not able to do a membership but you're able to contribute something, please check out our website, www.trafficaeurope.org, and look for our GoFundMe page. We really appreciate anything that you can offer. If you don't have the means to contribute financially, please consider liking, commenting, and sharing our post with others who might share a similar interest. We can really use the help accessing a bigger audience. In any case, I want to thank you all so much for listening to this episode and wish you all a great day.